So by planting all of these flowers, by creating all of these habitat, overwintering sites, nesting sites, host plants for butterflies, a lot of butterflies have a special relationship with specific plants that their caterpillars can eat, like the monarch and the milkweed. Creating all of these opportunities for biodiversity will allow for more balance of that. So you won't.
This is a really cool interview that I did on Earth Day at Gurgitch Winery in Napa. They're an amazing, regenerative, organic certified farm, which will be a whole other video that I'm going to do about the regenerative organic system, which is amazing if you don't know about it already. And I interviewed the Monarch Butterfly booth, and she was just a wealth of information of all the different ways that we can use native pollinators for our landscape and our farms, and just create a more diverse environment when we're growing food or just trying to restore habitat. Instead of trying to dominate nature, just really using nature as we get our needs met at our homes and our homesteads, and really just creating oases in our homes so that our homes truly become regenerative. So they're not just these places where we take things out of the earth, but we actually give back and create for other life forms and other creatures. So without further ado, the interview with the Monarch Butterfly booth at Gurgitch Vineyards Earth Day Celebration. I hope you enjoy it. Please leave questions and comments below, and have a great day.
So my name is Erin Arnstein. I am the Western Program Coordinator at Monarch Joint Venture, and we're a national organization that focuses on the conservation of monarch butterflies and other native pollinators. Awesome. So I'm here today to talk about monarch butterflies and native bees and other native pollinators. So I run a program called the Monarchs and More Western Habitat Program, and that program we give away free native wildflower seeds and native milkweed plants to landowners in the state of California and in Southern Oregon as well. So quite a big program that we run. So the monarch butterfly has gone down pretty drastically, their population. From the 1980s to now, they've decreased by about 95%. So what we encourage is people rebuilding habitat. So planting lots of nectar flowers if they live along the coast. And then if you're inland, planting native milkweeds. So that's the only plant that the monarch butterfly caterpillar will eat.
Right.
So it's really important that we have native milkweeds.
And the native milkweeds don't grow near the coast?
So that's a great question. So the reason we don't want the native milkweeds growing along the coast, they haven't historically grown there. This is a little map put together with priority action zones. So along the coast, that's where they overwinter all through the winter months. And then they fly inland to seek out milkweed to breed and then lay their eggs. And then that milkweed is the host plant. So the milkweed didn't traditionally or historically occur along the coast. And we don't want to confuse their migration. So if we have milkweeds along the coast, that can potentially trigger them to go into reproduction. They're supposed to be in diapause and resting in the winter. So it could potentially trigger them to want to lay eggs and reproduce, and they're not supposed to be doing that.
And just a quick question. So is it, so they overwinter in California?
But
do they also go to Mexico?
So there's two different populations of monarch butterfly. So the ones that we deal with in California are the western population west of the Rocky Mountains. And so they overwinter along the coast of California. And then there's the eastern population that overwinters in Mexico, specifically Michoacán, Mexico. And they fly through the Midwest and up into Canada and then back. And then our population flies from the coast and then inland towards the Rocky Mountains and the north. So a very incredible migration, incredible species that's definitely worth protecting and, you know, planting some flowers to protect them is important.
So can you speak more about what would be beneficial on the coast for the monarch?
So if you live along the coast, the best thing that you can do, don't plant milkweed, but plant tons of native nectar flowers.
So what would be an example of a native nectar flower? Several.
So several examples would be phacelia, which is the beautiful purple flower. Pacific aster is a really great one. Buckwheats are really great for bees and butterflies.
But more the perennial or the annual?
Those are mostly perennial.
Right.
Your annuals can be things like clarkias, like more of the wildflowers.
Mm-hmm.
Poppies, that sort of thing. Poppies are actually good for bees, but don't really do anything for monarchs because they only really produce pollen. They don't really produce nectar.
Okay.
So monarchs don't want pollen. They want nectar. But they're beautiful and they help bees.
You were just saying that there's a resource that you can look up your address. Can you say what that was?
Yeah. So there's a really great native plants database that through the Native Plant Society called calscape.org. And you can go there and you can enter your address and whatever species of plant you're looking for to see if it has historically grown there. So if you wanted to find out if milkweed grew in your area, you could type in your address and whatever species of milkweed or just milkweed in general, mm-hmm. and it'll tell you if it grew there. And it's, there's a really great visual map and lots of great information about the plants. And then there's other resources like these really great plant lists from our partners at the Xerces Society. They put together... really great lists that are regionally specific. So this one I have here is from the California Central Coast.
Cool.
So really great information. And then Monarch Joint Venture has a lot of great lists and information on their website as well, monarchjointventure.org.
So we were talking off camera about how, you know, my particular home is sort of near the coast, but back a large mountain from the coast. So in that way, deciding whether I should plant a milkweed for monarchs is something that I'd need to consult these resources to see if it would actually be beneficial for them. Because I think we did.
Right.
I think we planted it, and now I'm going to go tell my wife, like, oh, I don't know if we actually should have planted that or not, but we can for sure. And I guess the other question would be all of the flowers that you talked about, those could go anywhere, right? It wouldn't be detrimental to plant them in the same habitat as the milkweed.
Yeah, the more habitat, the better. So the more food resources they have, mm-hmm. the better, because they're going to be taking a pretty incredible journey, from their overwintering sites inland and then back through four generations. So it's really important that you have lots of flower resources.
Right.
Just the more, the better.
Yeah, good. Yeah. And specifically, you were saying that if we planted the milkweed in the coastal habitat, that might disrupt their natural migration, and we don't want to do that.
Yeah, we just don't want to plant the milkweed. The kind of rule of thumb that the scientists have created is 10 miles from the coast. If you're within 10 miles of the coast, you don't want to plant milkweed.
Okay.
That's where all their overwintering happens. They should be in diapause. They should be at rest, and you don't want them to think that they need to.
What does that mean in diapause at rest?
Diapause is basically their reproductive diapause. They've gone into a moment of rest, and they're not in the reproductive mode.
But they're still a butterfly.
They're still a butterfly. They're just resting. Roosting. So that's what it's called when they all cluster in the leaves of the trees. They're resting to...
So is that what we see in like Pacific Grove when you see the monarchs in the trees there?
Yeah. Pacific Grove, Pismo Beach. There's a lot of those sites.
What are some of the other ones?
Arches. There's tons of them all along the coast. So the Xerces Society has a really great website.
And they'll show you all those sites.
Yeah, if you go to Xerces.org, they have a really great website about overwintering
Fantastic.
Sites.
That's
and
cool.
They do the overwintering count. So they count the butterflies every year, and that's kind of how we get our initial numbers for the season.
Nice. All right, let's transition on to these wonderful native bees that most people don't think about or talk about.
Yeah, so this is some information that is, I think, some of the most important information that you could have when dealing with native bees. So oftentimes when you hear about saving the bees, you think about honeybees, which are great. Honeybees are a really important agricultural, they do an agricultural service for us where they pollinate a significant percentage of our agricultural crops in the Central Valley especially. But they are not native. They're a domestic wild or domestic livestock, basically.
Yeah, right.
So without humans, they wouldn't be here. But we have all of these other wonderful native species of bees. We actually have 1,600 species of native bees in California alone. So that's a huge number of species. And most of those species live in the ground or they live in sticks. So there's this really great nesting and overwintering habitat that Xerces put out that is just incredible. So it has, we're really lucky at Monarch Joint Venture to partner with Xerces and really promote their resources as well as our own. So
can you explain this one?
Yeah, so what's happening here, this is a, if you can see it, this is a species that's nesting in a stick. So
that's inside a stick.
That's inside a stick. So this could potentially be that stick. Mm-hmm. And so really what we're trying to encourage is maintaining your habitat in a different way. So you can plant lots of flowers and have pollen and nectar for bees, but if you don't have habitat for them to nest in, then they're not going to be able to complete their life cycle. So it's really important that you have a full life cycle, including nesting sites. So this is kind of how you can create stem habitat. So you basically leave your dead flowers as they are in the winter, and then in the spring you can chop those heads off. Usually it's, you want it to be about 65 degrees before you start chopping those heads off, in case anything was nesting in there. The heat and the sun will trigger the bees to be active again. So then you can deadhead those stems, and then those stems will just stay at the base of the flower, and you'll see they'll start to build their nests. So these native bees are going to be collecting pollen and nectar.
Do they leave any indication that they're nesting, or you just kind of assume that they might be in there?
Usually, so with the stick nesting bees, they'll usually cap the top.
Oh, interesting.
So you'll know that that one is taken care of. And then there's other species too, like this little example that I have. This is actually a wasp, but you can see it had an entrance hole and then it had an exit hole.
Oh, interesting.
And then this is what it kind of did.
I hope that that translates in the camera.
Yeah, it's kind
fuzzy.
Of a hard one to see.
Yeah. So what is that in there that we were looking at?
This actually is probably a little type of metallic sweat bee. It's kind of hard to see, but you can see.
But it's a bee. Those are like, they were larvae
little,
or something? Or?
Yeah, so it's basically, this is what's happening. They are, there's a pollen ball that the larva is feeding off of, and the mother bee is creating these little chambers.
Oh, they create the little chambers. Oh,
yeah, so
cool.
They're all stacked up on each other vertically in those stick
cool.
nests.
Oh, cool. And how many little bees will one of those single species bees?
It kind of depends on the species. So, yeah, it just depends on the species. But the other thing, too, that is important to note is that of the 1,600 species of native bee, 75% of those are ground-dwelling bees. So they actually live in the ground. So part of your habitat, as well as, you know, trimming your stems and leaving them for them to have habitat with the nests, is to also leave some bare ground. So if there's some nice loose bare ground, a lot of species of native bee are going to use that as their nesting sites. So you'll see the nesting sites are created like this. So they have a nice little chamber where they put their pollen for their babies to eat. And then other things that you can do, you can leave dead wood, and if you have holes in that wood or you drill holes in that wood, you can attract bees that way, native bees. And then stick piles, brush piles, stone piles, all of those are really great opportunities for nesting habitat for native bees and other insects as well, and birds, honestly. So you're really creating a full habitat. So this is a good example. In August in this garden, there's some really great flowers still there. And then come November, this gardener is leaving their plants and leaving their leaves. That's a really important part of habitat, is leaving your leaves on the ground. A huge majority of moths, their larvae are growing in the leaves. So if you just really, pollinator gardening is very hands-off.
Yeah.
You can just
And then are there would you say, or do you know, are most of these native bees and moths, are most of them not going to damage, you know, your food crops that you're growing on your home site, or is it sort of a mix? Or
yeah, so all of really the native bees, they're not going to really damage your crops at all. If anything, planting more floral opportunities for them to feed on, to get, really they're just trying to get nectar to eat, and then pollen for their babies.
Right.
And so they're not going to damage your crops at all. And if anything, the more flowers you plant, the more beneficial insects you're going to bring in, such as predatory wasps. Right. They'll come in and they'll start to parasitize your pests in your garden and that sort of thing. So you can create a really amazing biodiverse life cycle with these practices.
And did you bring up moths? Did I hear you correctly in the
I didn't.
Habitat?
I brought up moths with the leaves.
Leaf color.
Yeah.
Leaf
so.
Because that's the scourge of many home gardeners, is the moths that eat up all their vegetables. So is there, how do we mitigate that? Or is that a mitigation issue at all?
You know, moths are extremely important pollinators. Mm-hmm. And specifically, you know, I think one of the big problematic species is the sphinx moth, or the hummingbird moth, that is a nighttime pollinator. So it gets a lot of nighttime pollination done. But its caterpillar form is the tomato hornworm.
Oh,
so that causes damage. You know, that's a crop that people want.
Right, right.
So what I usually do in that instance is I just have a sacrificial plant. So if I have a ton of tomatoes that I'm growing, I just let one be there for that life cycle to occur.
Oh, great. That's a great idea.
Yeah. It just is. Yeah. It's part of the natural process. They're there for a reason. So are we.
I guess it's sort of hard for most of us to get out of the mentality of, we don't want that particular bug. We only want these other bugs. We have to sort of embrace the totality and then figure out how to
balance it all.
How to balance their needs with our needs. And and I think that's even for me, that's hard to be like, okay, I'm going to you know, the fear is like, oh, if I let this one live, then it's going to take out all of my tomato plants.
Right. But so the answer to that situation would be, if you only have one species of plant and one species of pest, you're not bringing in all that biodiversity.
Yeah.
So by planting all of these flowers, by creating all of these habitat, overwintering sites, nesting sites, host plants for butterflies, a lot of butterflies have a special relationship with specific plants that their caterpillars can eat, like the monarch and the milkweed. Creating all of these opportunities for biodiversity will allow for more balance of that. So you won't get just the one plant and the one pest.
Yeah.
You'll get your plant, some pests, and then some predators.
Right.
It'll become a whole ecological system that you're helping to create.
Yeah.
And honestly, you know, nature doesn't really need us. We've kind of gotten in the way. So,
but we can be a beneficial part of that dynamic. For
it's
sure.
up to us now to fix it and to bring it all back. So, if we are creating an ecosystem where we have our hands in the ecosystem, we want to make sure that it's as biodiverse as possible.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, in my personal garden, and what I think the viewer would be interested in is this idea that we want our tomatoes, we want our potatoes, we want our cauliflower, we want our broccoli, we want our arugula, you know, we want our cilantro and our basil, and the more we integrate them together, you know, I guess that's kind of what you're saying. It's just like, the more diversity, the more polyculture, obviously the more resilient the system will be, and then more, it's just a win-win for everybody.
Absolutely,
And I guess we will lose a couple plants or fruits here and there, but the sum total of the yield and the biodiversity and the biomass is going to be so much greater.
Absolutely, and it's going to benefit your soil, it's going to benefit just everything around your ecosystem that you're creating. Your crops are only going to be better for it, because they're going to have more flavor. I was an organic farmer, and my husband is still an organic farmer.
Yeah.
And he does this all the time, where he has his crops and then he has insectary rows within his crops, because he wants to bring in all of that life and all of that biodiversity. So those little natural battles can occur.
What about, like, you know, single bed, like, let's, so most of the viewers are going to be DIY homestead or home garden types. What about, like, you know, the 4x8 planter box?
Yeah.
But that's like a monoculture a lot of times. It's just like a little mini monoculture.
Yeah. So, you want to just incorporate more flowers. If you can
in
get,
that monoculture?
Or, I would.
So skip the monoculture and just go polyculture even in the 4x8 bed.
I would try to get as much biodiversity even within in a little space. And that might just be, you know, planting some flowers just along the edges that aren't going to take up that much space.
And so this one is the chocolate midge.
So this one is just a fun one. This little teeny midge is what pollinates cacao trees, and so without this little insect we wouldn't have our chocolate, so that's a really important one.
Awesome, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for all the wonderful information. And do you want to let viewers know how to contact you or what your organization?
This one is the most important one. So if you are interested in building habitat on your property, this is the program that I run with Monarch Joint Venture. It's the Monarchs and More Western Habitat Program, and it is for landowners in the state of California and Southern Oregon that have a quarter acre or more to dedicate to habitat. We give wildflower seeds and native milkweed plants to landowners so that they can build that habitat. And you can reach me at, you can look up the program at monarchjointventure.org, or you can email me, Erin, E-R-I-N, @monarchjointventure.org.
Great. Thanks, Erin.
Thanks.